Welcome to NHASCD Spotlight. It's our podcast from the New Hampshire Association for Supervision and Curriculum Development. My name is Bill Carrozza, the Executive Director. Coming up soon, a free webinar with Lindsay Prendergast and Piper Lee. They wrote the book, Habits of Resilient Educators, Strategies for Thriving During Times of Anxiety, Doubt, and Constant Change. That webinar is coming up April 2nd from 4 to 5 p.m. after school. It's a free webinar, and you can register also at nhascd.org. Well, my guest today is Star Sexton. She is an educator, been over 20 years in the field, now works as a speaker, author, consultant, instructional coach. Her roots began in 2012. She was named an outstanding educator by Education Update. Also in that year, earned National Board certification. She's a certified master journalism educator and ASC an emerging leader. And also featured in the TEDx talk, A Recovering Perfectionist Journey to Give Upgrades. I know Star as a writer, primarily a prolific author on topics as wide as blogging, assessment, peer feedback, social emotional needs, and leadership. She travels the world, in her words, to change the world one mind at a time. As I follow influencers in education, I certainly would list Star as one of the leading innovators in our field. Thanks for joining us today, all the way from Tampa, Florida, Star.
Thanks for having me, Bill. I love NHASCD. I've loved your organization for a really long time now.
Well, that means a lot. I know you were on a webinar in the midst of the pandemic back in, I think, 2020, right?
Yep.
Yeah, that was my time away from the board. And now, of course, I work for the organization. So I share your love for NHASCD really since probably 2002 or even prior to that. You know, I was prepping for this podcast. It was difficult finding a single lane to describe what you do because you do so much. I mean, your books, your workshops, your connections cover a wide range of educational topics. If you could describe like a single mission, and maybe you can't do that, which is fine, or as they say, an elevator speech maybe, for what you do in this field, what would that be, Star?
So I would say it's two-tiered. I think what I'm most driven by is a real desire to put students in charge of their learning. So also, how do we set up systems and structures that elevate educators who put kids in that scenario? So my time in the classroom was very much about innovating that space to be able to give kids that not only the power to be the owners of their own learning, but the understanding of how to do that in a meaningful way. And then as I stepped out of the classroom and started working with teachers on that mission, thinking about ways we can honor all the amazing things educators do while also empowering them and their kiddos. So I'm about impact. I'm about whether it's impact with kids, impact with adults, and helping educators see how important they are to this mission. I don't think educators get enough positive press. And every educator I've ever met, with the exception of very few, are amazing human beings who are in this for the right reasons. And I think too often we focus too heavily on like the 1% who are not ill-suited for, you know, who are ill-suited for the profession.
Well, that message is more important than ever. And I hate to keep on talking about the pandemic, but clearly that kind of hit us in the nose a little bit. And I think that your mission is so important. You know, I remember you, I think one of the first times, I had to go back in my memory, I read you was in a Cult of Pedagogy article with Jen Gonzalez, really one of the best blogs out there, without a doubt. And it was 2015. You were just a youngin' then. And you had written the book, Hacking Assessment, 10 Ways to Go Gradeless. I think that got you started a little bit in our field as a consultant too. That is still probably something you preach about and talk about. Am I right?
All the time. I mean, I just had a second edition of Hacking Assessment come out about a year and a half ago. And in the 7 years in between the first one and the second one, my thinking has definitely evolved. The deeper the more opportunities I've had to work with schools and see those shifts that are happening now post-COVID, and also a big interest in lots of states with competency-based learning in particular, and what that looks like, not just for CTE programs, although that's where a lot of competency-based learning kind of starts. Right. But, you know, thinking more along the lines of mastery learning and what that looks like for kids, to demonstrate what what good learning looks like.
Yeah, New Hampshire's been a bit of a leader in the competency-based movement. We could talk about that for an hour. So I think it's your latest book talks about student-led assessment. Of course, you're about to show me on the screen. Oh, yeah, it's beautiful. And too bad we can't see it. And of course, it deals with something we talk about a lot. I don't want it to become a cliche, but, you know, student agency. So it seems to mold well with your perspective on gradeless assessment and competency-based assessment. Talk about your latest book and what impact that has had already, probably on your thinking as a conference leader and workshop leader, but also with teachers.
So, I mean, what's interesting is I wrote Hacking Assessment, and there are lots of individual things that go on in the 10 chapters of that book. And over the years, folks have really asked me about different pieces of it. So the ASCD book about reflection kind of came out of one of the chapters specifically about metacognition and how we use that as a means to help students understand the way they learn and also to make visible the parts of their learning that we can't see. And then there was also another book about peer feedback, because people are always asking me about peer feedback. And the last piece of all of that is really portfolio and student-led conferences. People have seen the videos of my students talking about their learning. And it's been, you know, like, nobody can contest the fact that having a student who can articulate both where they started and where they ended up and how they got there is pretty much the goal of education, getting them to be able to articulate goals and act plan of actions to get them to their goals. And this book is all about that. It's about how do we set up structures in our schools, in our classrooms, where kids can track their own progress through portfolio systems, and then how we can use portfolio as a means to provide evidence of learning in those really important conversations we have with students.
I'm good friends with a guy named David Nigadula. I don't know if you know David, but almost sort of, in fact, I'm going to see him this afternoon, almost the inventor sort of the digital portfolio. So I think all the time about how we can return learning to students. And you travel the world, you have a greater perspective than almost anybody. It feels like, and maybe I spend too much time talking to smart people like you, but it feels like we're returning to more pedagogy and good teaching, and not just focusing on the content, but also focusing on the student. Do you see reason for optimism in our field right now?
I do. I think that even though the cause of how we got back to this place might not have been awesome, I think that the fact that we are having different conversations, we're moving away from standardized test data, for example, as a means to knowing about what kids know and can do, and more towards, like I said, this competency approach where learning dispositions are embedded in the way we think about learning overall. So it's not just, I've mastered this content for this content area, these skills. It's giving kids the knowledge and awareness and language to talk about the transfer of those things in a variety of different places. And I think that conversation is happening with greater frequency now than it has in a long time, because, you know, education has its cycles, and this is not a new thing per se. I think it's just an old thing with a new spin, given the way society has changed since the last time it came around.
Yeah, it's a chicken or egg thing. Do we reflect society or vice versa? You know, and I think we forget that we can't change the course of human history a lot, and we have to almost react to it. And in some ways, technology has been a major theme throughout your career. In fact, I'd love to talk, maybe it's not the time now, I'd love to talk about your perspective on social media. Maybe we'll get to that in a couple of minutes, because that's something that you do as well. But how do you see technology right now affecting education? You know, a lot of research is showing that all the money we've put into tech in the last couple of decades hasn't made a huge amount of difference in academic strength. How are you seeing that right now? Are you seeing that we're backing off of technology a little bit?
I think that there are quite a few teachers who are really put off by AI and concerned about how much screen time kids already have. And again, post-COVID, they spent so much time on screens and how they did things that I think there is this almost regression back to paper and pen situations, which, you know, isn't necessarily bad one way or the other. I think that if you're using technology in a way that could be done with a paper and pen anyway, then you're not using the technology well. And just because the new shiny object is technology and you want to say you're using it, putting worksheets on an iPad isn't using technology effectively. So I would like the message to be out there that, yes, things are changing with technology, but rather than being fearful of the changes, we need to embrace them, see the positive benefits of using it, understand that there's always going to be a downside to any new thing that comes out, and instead of running from it, really try to understand how it can be useful. And with AI in particular, like I started, like now as I'm planning workshops, I'm playing with AI in different ways and trying to see what I can get from it so that when teachers ask those questions, I could have at least some experience saying, you know what, it's going to make your job easier. You don't see it yet, but it's going to. And, you know, kids are using it. So to take your head out of the sand a little bit and say, we're going to ignore it while we're in schools, I think you're being foolish, because kids are definitely on the train usually before we are. And if they're going to use it, we might as well try to understand it and let them teach us about how they're using it so that we could teach them how to use it better, you know, to better help their own education and succeed in their goals in a lot of different ways. And I think that it's a powerful tool that's not going away. I think it's just going to be continue to be refined and even more impressive as time goes on, I think.
AI has almost replaced almost any other new issue in education, including social media. But you are involved with that. You're a consultant to people around social media to some extent. I was a very early adopter as a principal of social media, and I'm disappointed where some of it has gone, certainly. And it's not, I don't know, it's overall, it probably has been a positive, but maybe more so negative thing. Where are we at right now? And obviously with Elon Musk's change to Twitter, which really disappoints me because I love Twitter in the early days, especially, was so exciting. Where do you see that standing? And should educators, should kids use social media these days?
When I was still in the classroom, I said yes. I mean, I got really involved as a journalism teacher in particular. I felt it was my duty to teach kids to use social media for a lot of academic reasons, instead of just assuming because they're on those spaces that they actually know how to use it that way. Being a consumer of any platform is different than being a content creator for that platform. And I think we need to err on the side of content creation, curation, different skills that are essential skills in the 21st century for kids to be able to go online and tell the difference between what is AI generated and what is legitimately human made. And also, you know, kind of thinking about just facts. Let's go back to like standards that came in a million years ago about facts and details, as opposed, you know, facts and opinions. I think with how much social media is out there and how anybody could blog now, and we take blogging as journalism, which it isn't always, because it's not trying to be fair and balanced. It is just one-sided most of the time. And so we need to teach kids to be really good consumers of what's out there, first of all. And we have to be good consumers ourselves, modeling how that those platforms could be a way of bringing people together, amplifying voices, amplifying ideas. And also, you know, making sure that we're using them in really positive and affirming ways, as opposed to, unfortunately, the way so many folks use social media now to hurt other people.
You encourage educators to blog or heck, even do a Substack?
You know, I'm not as familiar with Substack, but I think that blogging in general, I think it's important for individual educators to share their unique stories, whether they're doing it on a free platform, or they have a website with a blog component, or they're blogging for Edutopia, or like me, I used to blog for Edweek. And I think that it's a service to put a face, a real face, with the experience of being an educator, because that, like I said at the start of the show, there aren't enough positive voices talking about the amazing work that people are doing. And sometimes if we could get a few good blogs that really elevate those voices and people have a spot to go to look at that, I think it could really do wonders for our profession in general right now.
One of the things I think that makes you unique a little bit is that you have your hand in almost every type of teaching. I mean, I know you work in classrooms, you write, you blog, you do large keynote presentations as well. And I know you're going to be speaking at ASCD probably next month. I have to be careful because I'm not sure when this podcast is going to drop. So it could be next week, but we'll see. The ISTE Conference, World Ed Summit, as well as PDK, which is kind of fun. Talk about what you're going to be talking about. What works right now in terms of, you know, the big keynotes? Because people poo-poo that, but I've learned a lot from hearing, I don't know, Grant Wiggins or Doug Reeves or whomever in a large setting.
Yeah, you know what's funny is, like, I'll do a keynote, but the work, like, I like to do the granular work. I like to do the work, the hard work of implementation. I like to be with my teams as they're experiencing the push and pull of some of these ideas. And although I love the idea of inspiring people to take action, I really would rather be on the ground with them as they're taking action. Sure. Because to me, that's more gratifying work than a keynote. Although I also see the keynote as an opportunity to share important ideas with a large room full of people who might not know about my work.
Right.
I think for women in leadership in particular, there aren't enough women voices, even in a profession that's largely made up of women. A lot of those keynote voices are male voices.
Yeah.
No, but, you know, I mean, not to say that each one of those men that speak aren't well-qualified men. I just think that we also need to amplify more voices of color and more women voices, because, like I said, we're living in it sometimes a little bit more than some of those folks who have been away from it for a while. And part of my ongoing work is always sort of staying really connected, even though I'm not in a classroom anymore all the time, staying really connected to folks who are, so that I don't lose sight of the reality of that experience. And I still kind of hold out hope that I might end up back there at some point. The sessions that I'm going to be working on are largely around the student-led assessment book. So, like, that came out this year. So a lot of it's going to be around elements of that. And then the other, I have another book coming out with Routledge later this year about making an impact outside the classroom. So a lot of the panels are about elevating the different things educators do and can do if they need a little bit of a break from where they are right now. That, you know, there's no better career to prepare you to do just about anything else in the world also. Do a lot.
At NHASCD, we partner a lot with the Principal Association, the Superintendent Association, a technology group. And we have co-sponsored in the past a Women's Educational Leadership Conference for the state. It's only a couple of years old, I think. So that's definitely something we agree with wholeheartedly. It seems like, and this is way off the rails, and we're not following any of the questions that we put in our Google Doc necessarily, but that's pretty typical. How do you do all you do? I mentioned we have a webinar coming up on resilience for educators with Lindsay Prendergast and Piper Lee. It seems to me a big piece of what educators need right now are some of the basics, like sleep and exercise and a good mindset. You must do all, I mean, some of that's probably natural for you, but you must have good routines in order to do all the things that you do and travel and that sort of thing.
Oh my God, yes. I mean, but that took a fair amount of work. When I was in my leadership role, my health quickly kind of unraveled because my routine was completely destroyed. Like, when I started, I didn't realize that I wasn't going to be able to work out in the afternoon or evening, that I'd just be so spent by the time that I got home. The last thing I wanted to do was anything. I like kind of wanted to eat and go to bed. That was it. And then, so what I ended up doing is I flipped my schedule. I started waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning and working out and kind of getting that time for myself. And then getting to bed earlier on the flip side of that. And now that I work from home mostly, I really try to set up my day where if I need to go out for a walk after being on several calls for a little bit, just to give my brain some time to kind of get out of the mindset of wherever I was before, or just need some time to like breathe and take in the air and move around. I really make that a priority in my life now, eating well. And, you know, I'm not getting any younger either. That's the other thing too. I think when you're in your 20s and 30s, you don't think about the impact of your choices. And then when you get to your 40s, you can't ignore what those choices have kind of done to you. So now as a person in my late 40s, you know, thinking, what do I do next? What is, you know, how does this all look? Not to mention the fact that my child is in college now. So there's one less thing, but also it's a different kind of worry that happens when they go away. And I travel a lot for work. So those routines also have a lot to do with the way I structure even my time away from home, making sure that I get up early, I work out in the morning, that I eat well, even though I'm not eating in my own house, and what that looks like. We have to take care of ourselves and each other a little better than we do. Kind of be there for each other and be acutely aware of the things that we need if we are ever going to elevate empathy in what we do to something greater than what it is right now.
One of my other jobs, and this is a total self-serving question, is I teach in a college with pre-service educators, and we're constantly trying to pump them up because the voices they may be hearing may not always be positive. What advice do you have for that? Well, even a high school senior about to go to higher ed for teaching, or those in the midst of it right now. I've been talking to a lot of students who are student teaching right now, and they're pretty excited still. What do you think? What should we say to them? How can we encourage them?
First of all, I love pre-service teachers and pre-service teacher programs. And if it's ever an opportunity, I do spend a lot of time talking to pre-service teachers, whether during assessment chapters, if folks are using my book as a part of their class, I will zoom in and I will say the things that professors don't necessarily feel comfortable saying, just about being in the reality of being in the field and the importance of what we do. But there is no greater profession in my mind than education. I do not think, however, that people should sacrifice their lives and their health and their livelihood to any career. And it's easy to do that in education. We give so much of ourselves all the time in this profession, to the point where we could give at our own expenses, to the expense of our families. I don't know how much my son, if you asked him, how he would feel about the work I've done over the years. I mean, I'm sure he's proud of the work, but I know it took me away from him at times. So I wonder if there will ever be a conversation about resentment, about how much time I've spent with my students versus him, or now the teachers that I work with. But the seniors that I always worked with, I always tried to couch this idea of going into higher ed as this opportunity to explore the things you're passionate about. And should education be the thing you're passionate about? I say, you know, if your heart is in the right place, then it will work itself out. It's finding a good fit. It's okay to take a job and then realize once you're there that it's not the right place for you. And that could be the thing that makes or breaks a career in education. I feel like if you're in the wrong school or the wrong district where your values don't align, that could be very stressful. And, you know, not the kind of opportunity we want young folks first getting into ed to experience. So, you know, it's hard. It's hard work, but it's rewarding work for sure.
Amen. That was great. Love to have you zoom in on a couple of my classes sometime to give that sort of very positive perspective. I think they need to know it's a hard profession, but you know what? Most professions are. My three kids are all in different professions, and everything they do is hard. So it's still the best profession in the world, but I'm a little biased. So as are you. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I will say too, like in terms of hard though, you know, I think we put the wrong focus. Like a good challenge is a good challenge. Right. And if you're somebody who enjoys critical thinking and problem solving and being really good on a dime, because sometimes you have to make decisions very fast when you're in a classroom. And that level of self-awareness where you could read a room is a skill that even if you're in education for a short time will transfer to any job that you have. Right. Like that resilience is something that we need to nurture a little bit more in ourselves, I think.
Right. So what does the future hold for Star? You talked about a new book coming up. Do you see your career shifting? Maybe, like you said, maybe even go back to the classroom for a while.
I think I have dreams of it. I always have when I've left the classroom, like the idea of being around kids on a more regular basis. I still consult with a lot of New York City public schools. So like I still see my people and I still get to be around their kids, and I'm grateful that they share them with me when I'm there and that I get to see the great work. That's how they've taken the work that I started in my own classroom and made it their own. I think as education continues to move forward, I'd love to see real policy change happen so that we're good. Like we don't have to worry about certain things. And I'd love to see a downplay of standardized testing at the state level and also at the national level in terms of how we rank and sort kids, and maybe move to a more portfolio, authentic-based sort of way of assessing what kids know and can do.
I had John Bergman on the podcast a while back. Yeah, John's a great guy. He's the creator of Flipped Learning. And he went back to Houston.
About mastery learning, though, too.
Oh, he did? Okay. Learning. I'll check that out. And he went back to the classroom, partly because he ran out of stories. You know, he was speaking everywhere, but he was probably 10 years out of the classroom. So he's back and seems very, very happy. I podcast with him. He was in his, you know, science lab. And I'm thinking, I wonder if that school realizes what a well-known dude he is. But
don't always. It's been my experience thus far that sometimes in your own backyard, regardless of what you've done and how you do it, that folks don't really recognize your impact locally. Kind of need to at least go to the next zip code in order to get some perspective.
Yeah, the prophet in your own town. Where can people find out more about you, Star, and everything that you do?
I have a website, MissSaxstein.com. Basically, everything for me is branded Miss Saxstein from when I was in the classroom. So my Twitter/X is at Miss Saxstein. I'm probably on LinkedIn the most now out of all of them. I too am struggling with the changes in Twitter. It used to be my favorite place, and I've kind of like I'm reluctant to walk away from it completely just because I do have a large following there. And although a lot of folks have stepped away, not everybody has, and new people are finding it all the time. But my website is really the best place because it has all my social links. It has, you know, ways to contact me, and it also has my most recent thinking on everything.
Yeah, we're struggling at NHASCD too. We post every day to X, to Facebook, to Instagram, and we're thinking about it. Well, you know what's next on that one too. So, well, you've got stuff you have to do because you're like one of the busiest people I know. So thank you for your time, Star. Appreciate it.
I appreciate it too, Phil.
So our mission at NHASCD is to serve as a catalyst for conversation and action to inspire excellence in teaching, learning, and leading. You can find links to what we talked about today in the show notes and, of course, on our Spotify podcast page, and really any podcast player has this podcast. You could find us still, anyway, on Twitter, X, Facebook, Instagram, at NHASCD. I'm Bill Carozza, Executive Director. We'll see you next time for NHASCD Spotlight. Take care, everybody.